You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we're in conversation with Vice President Kamala Harris. We discuss some pressing issues that Wisconsinites are facing and learn how the Democratic presidential nominee would address them if she wins the White House in November. That conversation is just ahead.
Now, Dean Kinetter joins me in the studio for the last day of our fall member drive here on listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. Listener donations are the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio programs. If you have been meaning to give, now is the time because the drive ends at 6 o'clock. Go online to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob. Good morning. This hour, we have a new goal. We're looking for 30 people to join in with a gift. Funding for WPR News will stay on track when that happens. We love these goals. These are exciting. Help us get there. Make your contribution right now in any amount that works for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Coming up in just a couple minutes, we'll talk with Vice President Kamala Harris in our coverage of the election. We reach out to candidates from both parties and pose questions to them about what matters here in Wisconsin. These are the kinds of conversations you can count on from Wisconsin Public Radio.
And those conversations take some money. They take some resources and some time. That stuff is listener supported. You really make it happen. It means that your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes these many topics and the selection coverage and so much more possible.
Choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift. WPR is your daily connection to Wisconsin. This member drive let us connect you with even more of what Wisconsin has to offer. You can ask for your state park sticker when you give $25 a month or more. Your support of WPR and your outdoor adventures, it all begins with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's a very cool gift. One of the many, many great reasons to give this drive. But sometimes it's worth backing up and asking yourself, what does public radio really mean? Well, it means listener-supported radio.
While we appreciate business contributions and federal and state tax dollars, listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR. Your contribution of any amount really does matter at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
When you listen to WPR on your way to and from work every day, sometimes on the weekend, you're going to be listening for hundreds of hours a year.
If you've never given to WPR before, make your gift today on this last day of the drive. Maybe $5 or $10 or $20 a month. If you're doing hundreds of hours of listening, that makes WPR an amazing information and entertainment bargain. Your gift, no matter what amount you choose, really does make a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Also really easy to give, takes just a few minutes of your time. Again, a gift of any amount. You are in the driver's seat. Maybe that's $10 a month.
That donation then is going to come back to you each and every day in the form of engaging programs. Show your support. Your gift really does make a difference. We can't do it without you. You could join the team right now. Online at WPR.org on this last day of the drive. You can also call 888-202-2552. And thanks so much for your support.
Now on Wisconsin Today, we spoke with Vice President Kamala Harris yesterday afternoon about several issues facing our state and how, as the Democratic presidential nominee, she would address these issues if elected in November.
Wisconsin Today also reached out to former President Donald Trump's campaign with an invitation to be on the program.
We started the conversation by looking at Harris's proposals to address a shortage of affordable housing. Turning first to housing affordability, Wisconsin has a shortage of affordable housing. Median home price in our state has jumped by 41% since September of 2020. You proposed up to $25,000 in down payment assistance for first-time home buyers. What would it take to be eligible for that type of assistance?
Well, first of all, let me just say that part of the housing issue writ large across our country is that we just don't have enough supply. And so part of my plan is what we need to do to increase supply and help people get their foot in the door, which includes the $25,000 down payment assistance. But let me just back up for a moment. Look, I grew up a middle-class kid. My mother worked long days, she worked weekends, and she was able to save up so that by the time I was a teenager, she was able to buy our first house. And so I understand and have as part of my lived experience, understanding, one, a lifetime practically of being a renter, and also what it means for families to aspire to own a home. But, hard, you know, it takes a lot of time, and that was many, many years ago, and the American dream of home ownership has become even more elusive. So my policies and my new plan to approach and deal with this problem is twofold. One, to work with the private sector and home builders to create incentives for them to build 3 million new homes by the end of my first term. And the second, to your point, is a $25,000 down payment assistance for first-time home buyers, and that's the threshold. First-time home buyer. And again, the point there is people just need help literally and figuratively getting their foot in the door. And once they're able to do that with having enough for a down payment, you know, folks work hard. They save up and the monthly payments will be more within their reach. But that down payment piece is really one of the big obstacles for first-time home buyers to be able to even plant themselves in a position where they can then build up their ability to buy a home. And frankly, home ownership is one of the best ways that people create wealth for their family and intergenerational wealth. So I'm very clear about the connection between this point and what can be a lifetime of economic opportunity for an individual or a family.
And if elected, you have said you'll work with private industry home builders to build these 3 million new homes and rental units during your first term. How do you incentivize the building of new housing that's affordable for the people who need it most?
So part of it is tax credits and creating tax credits for home builders, but home builders who are going to do the work of building homes that are affordable to middle-class people, to working people, to families. The second is to cut through the red tape that currently, you know, it exists in from local, state, and federal levels, and really cutting through the red tape so that we don't unnecessarily burden the ability to actually create this additional housing that brings down the cost of home ownership and rent. And part of it is also I have a plan to take on corporate landlords who they have to be held accountable. We've seen in so many places around our country, these corporations come in, they buy up a bunch of property, and then they jack up the prices, and it becomes too expensive for people to actually be able to afford to live where they work and where they want to live. And so that is a piece of it. And it's something where, you know, bad actors also need to be held accountable. But this is obviously a multi-pronged approach because the factors contributing to high rents and housing affordability are many. And my plan is to attempt to address many of them at once so we can actually have the net effect of bringing down the cost and making homeownership renting more affordable.
Let's look at water quality now. Communities all over Wisconsin struggling with toxic PFAS contamination in their water supply. And our state natural resources department, it's relying on a decades-old spills law to clean up emerging forever chemicals and hold businesses accountable. If you win the White House, would that lead to further federal regulation of PFAS?
Well, let me start with this. My commitment to these issues is longstanding. You may know, I mean, 20 years ago when I was elected DA of San Francisco, I created one of the first environmental justice units of any DA's office in the country. I, as Attorney General of California, was a real leader on making sure that we enforced rules and standards that were about reducing PFAS, about what we need to do to obviously writ large reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also hold polluters accountable. And so this is longstanding work and really, frankly, a deep-seated and longstanding commitment that I have to addressing these issues, including during the time I've been vice president, where we are in the process of delivering nearly $2 billion in funding to help Wisconsin and the communities within Wisconsin address toxic PFAS chemicals, including the work that we are also doing, which I've been a leader on, frankly, which is dealing with lead pipes and eliminating lead pipes and then, of course, protecting the Great Lakes from the climate crisis. And I just have to also mention that this is in great contrast to my opponent. Donald Trump refused to protect communities from PFAS, and he has sided again and again with polluters rather than with the families of Wisconsin. And I think there's a big contrast here on a very critical issue in terms of the public health and well-being of Wisconsinites.
Now to abortion. You've said you want to work with Congress to pass a federal bill to codify abortion rights. How do you plan to get enough support in Congress to restore abortion rights when you'd likely need to pass a Senate filibuster? You'd have potential legal hurdles.
Well, let me first say to all your listeners, you must reelect your Senator Tammy Baldwin, because we need the votes in Congress to do exactly what you are saying, and that's true. And it is well within our reach to hold on to the majority in the Senate and take back the House. And so I would also emphasize that while the presidential election is extremely important and dispositive of where we go moving forward, it also is about what we need to do to hold on to the Senate and win seats in the House. That being said, I've been very clear. I think we should eliminate the filibuster for Roe, and we need and get us to the point where we 51 votes would be what we need to actually put back in law the protections for reproductive freedom and for the ability of every person and every woman to make decisions about their own body and not have their government tell them what to do.
Vice President Harris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. Thank you so much.
That was Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris. We spoke yesterday afternoon. Wisconsin Today also reached out to former President Donald Trump's campaign, inviting him to be on the program.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as veterinary clinics get bought up by large corporations, two vet practices in southern Wisconsin form a worker cooperative.
I never thought that I'd be a part owner in a practice when I got out of vet school, just from a financial standpoint.
Veterinarians as business owners, that's ahead on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we hear from two veterinarians in southern Wisconsin who formed a worker cooperative for their animal hospitals. We'll find out about the potential for this business ownership model for vet practices.
That's just ahead. Right now, we're here to tell you that it is the last day of Wisconsin Public Radio's fall member drive. Dean Kinetter is here in the WPR News studio to talk about why it's so important that you join in right now.
It's how WPR works. The people who use it are the largest source of funding for it. It's a two-way street. You might have been meaning to give. If so, do it right now on the last day of this fall member drive at WPR.org or on the phone at 888-202-2552.
When 30 people join in this hour, we'll be on track to support the quality and variety of programs that you enjoy every day on WPR News. Wisconsin Public Radio is listener powered. That means your donation right now really does make a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just a few minutes ago, we talked with Vice President Kamala Harris. During our election coverage, we're reaching out to candidates from both parties, hoping to talk with them about issues that are important to Wisconsinites, things like affordable housing, PFAS pollution. We talked with the vice president about these are big conversations, important conversations, the kind of thing you count on from Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR is listener supported. That means your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Makes those conversations and all the topics you tune in for every day possible. Choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
take a minute to think about the stuff you spend money on every day. Maybe it's coffee, takeout. It can add up. It's pretty easy to spend on those things that are part of your daily routine.
Wisconsin Public Radio is part of your routine, too. It's your source for great conversation starters, news, entertainment, inspiration. So spend some money on it right now. On this last day of the drive, start with a dollar a day. That's $30 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It is not an overstatement to say that WPR exists because people contribute. When we all give, our contributions add up to make Wisconsin Today possible, make this entire service possible. Your contribution really does make the difference.
It's as simple as that. One gift at a time. Listeners, make Wisconsin Public Radio possible. So make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Jane from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm a sustaining member and a plan giver. I love Wisconsin Public Radio. As a matter of fact, I can't imagine my life without it. When I get up in the morning, Wisconsin Public Radio keeps me company while I get ready for the day. When I'm in the kitchen making a meal, Wisconsin Public Radio is always on, and I cannot imagine a weekend without the entertainment of Wisconsin Public Radio. Being a sustaining member has simplified my life because every time the fund drives would come on, I would think, oh my goodness, I have to get out my checkbook. Now I breathe easy knowing that I'm already a supporter. I would encourage you to consider doing the same for something that is such a vital resource for our community.
Make your gift at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. It's Wisconsin Today. Dean Knetter is with me for the last day of the fall member drive. Your support makes the news, information, conversations, and entertainment you enjoy on WPR possible. Your gift of $10 or $20 a month, whatever amount you choose, is the right amount to give.
You might be saying, well, that sounds great, Rob, but I'm going to support Wisconsin Public Radio tomorrow.
Well, hold on there, Dean.
Today. Yeah, hold on, cowboy. Well, today is actually your last chance to support WPR during this member drive.
Don't put it off. Join this amazing community of people coming together right now to make great radio. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So how do you know it's time to donate to WPR? Well, you are listening right now during our fall member drive, and whether you tune in for one favorite program like Wisconsin Today, Larry Mueller Show, or you check in repeatedly throughout the day or the week, you have made a habit of listening.
Now make a new habit, a habit of giving. Listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs. When you give, you make the programs and services you've come to rely on possible. It's easy to get started with a gift of $10 or $20 a month, whatever amount you choose. It takes just a few minutes online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Today is also your last chance to ask for that one-year Wisconsin State Parks Pass. When you give $25 a month or more, you'll be supporting one Wisconsin treasure, WPR, and getting access to a year's worth of another, our state park system. You can ask for that sticker now, again, a gift of $25 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Vernon in Stevens Point says, giving to WPR is the least that I can do because I listen several hours every day. Vernon, fantastic. Glad you're out there listening and glad you get how it works. You count on us for great conversations each and every day. We count on you to help pay for them. Make your gift, as Vernon did, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We really appreciate all the support. It is how things work around here. You keep the program going. You ensure a bright future for WPR, for yourself, and the entire state. Make a gift right now, WPR.org, or call us on the phone at 888-202-2552. And thanks.
Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Today. Now, veterinary practices around the country are increasingly being purchased by private equity firms, and the rates of corporate ownership are expected to more than double over the next decade.
But two vet clinics in southern Wisconsin, Spring Green Animal Hospital and Mazamani Animal Hospital, about an alternative to a corporate buyout. They formed what's believed to be the first veterinary employee-owned cooperative in the country.
Dr. John Daly and Dr. Eric Howlett are employee owners of Cooperative Veterinary Care, and they join us now. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, Kate.
And Dr. Daly, let's start with you. You owned Spring Green Animal Hospital for more than 20 years. Why did you want to avoid selling your practice to a corporation?
Well, I wanted to see it go on and be run by the people I'd been working with for many years, and I believed in the idea of bringing democracy to the workplace and wanted to see if we could make that work for our group.
How common is it for a corporation or a private equity firm to own a veterinary clinic?
It wasn't common at all years ago, but now it's really common. 60-70% of the emergency and specialty practices are owned by large companies, and probably 25% or more of small general practices now are also owned by companies. And just 10 years ago, that number would have been around 5%. And another 10 years from now, it's expected to be 50 or 60%.
What is behind that growth?
Well, in 2008 to 2010, there were a lot of things happened with the recession where a lot of companies suffered, and the private equity market looked at that years later and looked at the veterinary industry, and they saw that this was one industry that didn't really have as much of a downturn as others, and it was pretty recession-proof. And as more and more money became available to invest in new opportunities, they decided this was an industry and profession that was a good opportunity for them, and started the process of developing a corporate ownership model for veterinary practices.
Veterinary practices across the country. And Dr. Howlett, you previously worked at a corporate-owned vet clinic. Are those two working environments different from the situation you're in now?
I would say they are in some ways subtle and in some ways more significant. In the corporate-owned practice that I first worked in, the pressures on veterinarians were not necessarily indicating how we should practice medicine, you know, telling us what tests we should do and what drugs we should prescribe, but more in terms of increasing the number of patients that we'd see in a day. There were quotas put on staff members to try to sell things, to sell, you know, fecal tests and making staff feel more like they were salespeople as opposed to healthcare professionals.
What did that do to your feelings on the job? Did it lead to any type of burnout?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. When you're seeing 20 patients a day and staying till, you know, 10 o'clock at night to get good records on those patients and then have to wake up and do that again the next day, it's hard to have compassionate care for your pet owners and your pets.
Dr. Daly, turning to this model you have now, employee-owned, can you explain how that works and what are the benefits at your clinic for being an employee owner?
The benefits are a few. The big ones, I would say, are each member gets an equal vote in getting to make decisions for the business. So one owner, one vote. They get to participate in all the decision-making processes that happen and get to have their voice heard. And then if there's profit at the end of the year, which in a cooperative is called patronage, that gets shared in an equitable way. Particularly in our co-op, we set up a profit-sharing patronage formula, which was based on number of hours worked, not your role in the practice. So it didn't matter whether you were a veterinarian or
a tech or a kennel worker.
Exactly.
You could have perhaps an equal amount of benefit from that based on the hours you work.
Yeah. And it represents that we're all important, you know, and we each contribute differently to the success, overall success of a business. It's not just the people at the top or the veterinarians. It's everybody contributing.
But once you figured out the value of the business, how did you make it accessible for all employees to be able to buy into it financially?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can do that. And we spent a lot of time working with some professionals on different options. But eventually what we came to is we self-financed. We basically sold the current owners sold the business to the new group of owners, which were most of the people that had been working with us for many years. And they pay that back through the income of the business over the years, just like any other business loan.
Dr. Howlett, do you feel a difference in this type of practice where it is employee-driven, where the decisions are coming from the employees?
Absolutely. I think in my previous workplace, if I had an idea, I would have to pass that through, you know, not only my direct, maybe the medical director, but then the local management, and then it'd have to go up to a corporate manager. And here, we just make those decisions together. I think the democratic model that we have for our board structure has filtered down into how we interact in our staff meetings as well. And so we have a direct kind of shared decision-making model, which allows for us to all be fulfilled in our jobs.
What I wonder, though, is do you have to come to a consensus on how you set your rates and the cost of different procedures?
That's a fair question, and one that we have been grappling with in terms of, do we change certain pricing structures? How do you do that? You know, what is market rate? Which things that as normal vet staff and non-owners has been a learning curve for a lot of us, but I think also helps us understand where those pricing structures come from, which makes it not feel there's not a mystery behind that that exists in a corporate practice where you're like, why? This seems too expensive. It's like, now I understand.
Dr. Daly, are there benefits for the pet owner in a veterinary co-op ownership model?
I would hope so, but I want to be real careful to recognize that just because somebody works at a corporate-owned practice doesn't mean they're not trying just as hard as we do to provide good and compassionate care. The people that go into veterinary medicine do it because they love animals for the most part, and the structure that you work within might limit you somewhat to do the job in a way you'd like to, and so that there is that possibility, but I think everybody across the board, no matter what practice you work in, is trying their best to take good care of their patients.
We are talking about the business of vet clinics, vet hospitals with Dr. John Daly and Dr. Eric Howlett. They are employee owners of Cooperative Veterinary Care, and that's in southern Wisconsin. Dr. Howlett, as a semi-recent graduate of veterinary school, is the co-op model appealing to newly practicing vets?
I would like to think so. I'd like to hope so. So where else could someone come out of vet school and buy into a business with, you know, our member, I don't know what you would call it, the buy-in is a relatively low bar at $1,000. And that's something that's feasible as opposed to I never thought that I'd be a part owner in a practice when I got out of vet school just from a financial standpoint.
Has this model, business model for vet care, Dr. Daly, improved at all retention of staff, retention of veterinary technicians?
I think we're too new. We've only been doing this a year and a half. Mm-hmm. My hope is that we always had really good retention over the years, and that wasn't a problem, which is not necessarily the case for a lot of other places, and especially for corporate practices. They have a much more of a challenge with that. My hope is going into the future, we'll see this be an attractive model for the reasons that Dr. Eric was mentioning earlier, and you know, all the fulfilling aspects of it that would draw people that were committed to the idea.
Dr. Howlett, I understand at board meetings, you cast votes by saying woof and meow. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yay and nay are so boring, right? So sometimes it's a woof or a meow. Sometimes it's a moo or a nay. But, yeah.
That's that democratic thing coming up again.
Indeed,
you know,
indeed.
To each their own for their own pet. Is there anything else you would like to add about this model and about the future of the practice?
As John was speaking earlier, and I was thinking about the shared decision making and your question regarding, is this attractive for new graduates? I think the coming out, I just wanted to learn how to be a vet and be a good vet. And John is saying the same thing. He really just wants to be a vet. And none of us really want to be managers or lead business meetings. But here, because we share those responsibilities, it's a manageable little chunk that's distributed amongst all of us. So, not only do we share the rewards, but we share those responsibilities in a way that makes them, no big decision is resting on any one person's shoulders.
Hmm. It perhaps then makes also a more cooperative team, knowing that you're all doing something outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, and I want to echo a little bit of what Eric just said, and also just say that this is hard. It's not easy to learn new ways of communicating and collaborating and compromising. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of meetings, and that can get tedious at times. But I at least always walk out of meetings with this wonderful feeling that everyone is getting an opportunity, at least. Whether they always take it or not is up to them as individuals, but the opportunities are always there, and I always feel really good about that.
Well, Dr. Daly and Dr. Howlett, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. John Daly and Dr. Eric Howlett. They are employee owners of Cooperative Veterinary Care in Southwest Wisconsin. And they were with us for a look at the worker-owned ownership model for vet clinics.
Coming up, explore the mysteries of Wisconsin maps, including phantom communities that show up in maps, but not in real life.
There still might be an old building or something like that there, so they're interesting from that perspective, but they're certainly not places where you could stop for gas or cappuccino or something like that.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state cartographer's office is in the midst of an ongoing project to make Wisconsin's maps more accurate. It's currently documenting phantom locations that are on maps of the state, but they aren't actual communities.
Howard Varigan is Wisconsin's state cartographer based at UW-Madison. I talked to him earlier this month. I started out by asking him what he does when he finds out that a name on the map doesn't have much there.
Sure. So, you're talking about unincorporated places as well as cartographic phantoms, or at least that's what we call them. So unincorporated places are simply typically small rural locales where there might be a few homes, and there's typically some sort of sign that says, yes, this is a place called whatever. Cartographic phantoms, on the other hand, are places, often unincorporated places, that have disappeared for one reason or another, often because the population moved away. The tavern burnt down on the corner, and so there was, people didn't congregate there anymore. Sometimes because the place was miscoded on a map, and it was actually something more akin to a railroad crossing, but was shown on a map as being a community. So a lot of these cartographic phantoms, when you show up in that locale now, there's really nothing there at all, even though you'll find them on maps and even though you'll find them looking on your iPhone, looking at Apple Maps or Google Maps.
There's got to be a lot of fascinating stories. I wonder if some of these are maybe wishful thinking, like I'm a land speculator and Rob's Corners is the town of the future. And well, it never came to be, but the name stayed on a map somewhere.
That is absolutely true. There are cases like that where towns were settled and platted and people were hoping to make scads of money. And then the railroad, passed 5 miles to the south and the, village pretty much disappeared.
On a practical level, you mentioned this might show up on an online Google Map, Apple Map, whatever. One worry is people are driving along and saying, oh, I'm almost to Rob's Corners. Maybe we can stop for gas there. Well, Rob's Corners is just the intersection of two roads with maybe farmland here and a forest there.
Exactly right. And that's one of the reasons that for the project that we're working on at the State Cartographer's Office. We don't want to remove these places from the map, per se. We want to reclassify them so that they do show up as historical locales, perhaps. There still might be an old building or something like that there, so they're interesting from that perspective. But they're certainly not places where you could stop for gas or cappuccino or something like that.
And I love that part of the effort. You're not looking to pull out the eraser and take these places off the map. You want to preserve that history. Why is that important for you?
Well, it's important from the standpoint of both history as well as the standpoint of cartography. I mean, one of the purposes of maps is to record and document what is there on the ground. So simply erasing something from the map because it's a place that used to exist that doesn't exist now isn't really an appropriate thing to do. You may not show it on every map. You know, your map may not be appropriate to show historical places, but you don't necessarily want to erase them simply from, you know, from history or from memory.
Now, I've heard, I don't know if this is cartographic legend or not, I've heard that sometimes mistakes are introduced into maps intentionally for plagiarism reasons, copyright reasons. Is that something that actually happens?
It does. It's probably not as widespread as the myths would suggest. Those are sometimes called copyright traps. And in the past, they were introduced into some maps to, so that if a competitor copied your map, they copied the place that didn't exist, and you'd know that they did it. So it does happen.
And now do you – I saw on the State Cartographer website, you've got some pictures of these cartographic phantoms where somebody has gone to the place on the map where it's supposed to be and – observe the lack of community there.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because there's a couple of us who have been doing this research. Personally, I've visited probably over 1,000 of these, either unincorporated places, which do exist, or cartographic phantoms, which don't. Every county in the state, aside from Milwaukee, has cartographic phantoms and unincorporated places in them. So our goal is to simply go to these places and take a geotagged photograph, like on an iPhone, because that gives us the latitude and longitude, and it gives us the documentation of, yes, there's a place here, or here's the sign on the road that says it's Rob's Corners. So we've been to numerous places like this, and just trying to document their existence or non-existence, I guess you could say.
Something huge in the world of maps in my lifetime, your lifetime, paper. Right? I used to have a paper map when I went anywhere, or a triptych or whatever, and now we've gone digital. What are your thoughts? The advantages and maybe some of the things we lose when we change that?
So there are certainly implications of the loss of paper maps. It's good and bad, I would say. And it's a huge question also. I mean, it's hard to answer. That's really a thesis or, a dissertation or something. But I do believe that people have probably lost some of the abilities that we used to have for really deeply understanding how maps work and reading maps and so on. On the other hand, everybody's got a map in their pocket now. And as somebody who loves maps, I have to say, well, that's a good thing because people are interacting with maps on a day-to-day basis, which is something that they didn't necessarily do 15 or 20 years ago.
Now, on the daily basis, what we're interacting with maps for is to figure out how to go from here to there. That is just a small fraction of the kind of information, though, we get from maps. Can you give us a taste? Like, I often wish, and maybe there are maps, like, how many cows are there per unit of area in this county or whatever, a sense of the kind of information we can convey best in map form?
Well, another huge question, and, where do you begin? Another one of the transformations that's really happened over the last 15 to 25 years is the growth of geographic information systems as a way of storing and analyzing geographical information. And, back in the days of paper maps, it wasn't necessarily that easy to answer questions like that. Mm-hmm. But now it's relatively easy to take a map showing, the number of cattle density per area and then overlaying that with some geographical unit that you're interested in, some sort of boundaries, parcel boundaries or municipal boundaries to do those sort of what-if questions. So the application spans a very wide range from all of the disciplines that you could imagine at UW-Madison, for example. Many of them are now coming into the kind of the realm of geographic information systems, and that includes everybody from public health to, engineering and geology, and environmental science is huge in this area, geography, sociology, even history and the humanities. Mm-hmm. You can analyze historical texts to extract the geographical information from them and create visual displays of what this particular novel looked like in the mind of the author. So it's kind of, you know, like I said, endless or limitless what you, the uses you can apply geographic information systems to.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Absolutely.
Howard Varigan is the Wisconsin State cartographer based at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the world of Wisconsin map making and his team's effort to document cartographic phantoms in the state's maps.
Thanks for being with us here in Wisconsin today on this last day of our fall member drive. We're asking you to support the programs you value and listen to every day.
It's been so great hearing from you over the last few days. If we haven't heard from you yet this drive, though, today is the last day. Make a gift right now. And the great thing is it's a voluntary donation and you decide the amount. WPR's listeners supported. It means the more donors we have, the more secure our funding.
And many first-time donors, they give $120 or $10 a month. You decide the amount that's right for you. It's your choice, and WPR is something you value. So you'll find that donating, it feels really good. Find out right now on this last day of the drive at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.